Beer Talk. Gespräche über und beim Bier.
Hello and welcome to another episode of our podcast Beer Talk. Today I'm very happy I'm sitting here in Poland, Krakow, together with one of my beer idols, to be honest, and one of the guys who has maybe the most books on my beer shelf. It's Randy Mosher from the United States. Best known maybe on tasting beer, but also a lot of other books, and he's working on a new one. And we had a great speech of him today, so we're sitting here and want to talk a little bit to him. And first of all, thank you very much for having you here.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to people, so...
Perfect. And maybe you introduce yourself a little to our listeners and then we continue our talk.
I spent a career in graphic design and advertising, and eventually that sort of folded into my life as involved with brewing and breweries and brewery design, and then eventually into writing. But I started homebrewing in the middle 80s and read the Michael Jackson book, which was like sticking my finger in the socket and just electrifying and full of so many possibilities at a time when the U.S. brewing was completely boring. There was no interesting beer being made, almost none really anywhere. And so we started brewing Belgian beers out of Michael Jackson's book, because that book has so much detail. You really can brew a wit beer or a saison or a triple or whatever. So we just got really excited about the possibilities. And the first beers were terrible, and then they got better. And then eventually I was lucky enough to find someone who wanted to publish my messy pile of notes that I had created as my brewing workbook, and turned that into a book called The Brewer's Companion. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very flawed book, but it had a lot of information, and some of the things I had, like Dreimisch Verfahren and things like that were very technical from old brewing books and historical things that people found really fascinating that they had not seen before. I was just using old books and finding all the technical stuff and putting that in the thing. And then that was early 1990s. I left my job at an advertising agency and started freelancing. And at that time, a lot of people I knew from craft brewing knew that I could do design work, and they were starting breweries and said, "Hey, Randy, can you do some design work for me?" And then eventually my work became all design. And then at some point, I wrote Radical Brewing, because I had been writing for All About Beer magazine for maybe 10 or 15 years, and had lots of articles about, 12 ways to make a Christmas beer, and how to pervert a lager, and how to, like, all these kind of, just, I was trying to find things to say that were unique and interesting, and I combined that all together and made Radical Brewing, which we're just getting published in Poland here next week, so I'm very excited. Poland and Brazil are the only places outside of the U.S., and so I'm very proud of that. And then eventually got hooked up with Ray Daniels through our homebrewing club, and he and I did a lot of things. We almost started a brewery together in the 90s. We started teaching some classes at the Siebel Institute. They had never taught any classes on beer styles. In the whole 100-year history of Siebel, nobody really cared about beer styles. The breweries that were larger mid-sized breweries were sending their people. They didn't really care whether people knew about styles, because they only made what they made. And those breweries were just not interested in being innovative particularly. So, we turned that course into a somewhat simplified course for people in distribution and bar management and things like that. And that outline, or my PowerPoint deck, became the outline for Tasting Beer. Mm. And then, now I'm a writer and people are inviting me places, and like you get to go to all these, fabulous places and meet people and judge beer, and it's been a fabulous life.
Yeah, it's a fantastic journey. And to be honest, I also started with multimedia and a company making advertising and things like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, then you come across and then you have the beer and you have all the stories behind. So mm-hmm. that's something you really have to do. So, and I'm very happy because I also have some beers, which I brought from our Polish friends here. Mm-hmm. And we had four of them, and you selected the Rauchweizen, so the smoked wheat beer. And of course, I'm happy because I'm from Bamberg and we are these smoky guys, and you haven't been there yet, but maybe we will make it happen in the future. Yeah. But at least we have something that is a little Bambergian, maybe. Yeah. Let's hope so.
So
here we go. So at least it sounds and looks familiar.
Fantastic. So. Nice head on it. Nice haze. Well, I can smell the smoke from here.
So here we go. So,
well, cheers.
Cheers.
Prost.
May to have you. Prost. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to have it complete, the brewery is called Brovat Sam Jestem. And the beer, I hope I pronounce it right, is Jezwolny. That more or less means smoked wheat beer. So, okay, so yeah. If you get it, dear audience, you can taste it with us. And as you write a book called Tasting Beer, what will you say about this? What is in your glass?
I love the big head on it. You know, of course, the haze sort of comes along with wheat beers. It's got a very nice phenolic yeast component, which I think blends really nicely with the smoke and makes the smoke a little, like, integrates the smoke in with the beer somehow a little better. Sometimes the smoke beers, the smoke is so different from beer smell that they can seem like two different things that happen to be in the same glass. Not that that's completely bad, but I like that integration. Smoke level's fairly nice here. It's not, it doesn't obscure the beer too much. And it's very pleasant, the texture in the mouth. I love wheat beers.
Yeah.
if I were doing my own brewery, making what I would want, it would be all wheat beers.
Yeah.
Because I just really find wheat beers fascinating and tasty.
Yeah, I always say everybody likes a banana in a barbecue. So this is perfect. And to be honest, it's always interesting about the smoke level.
Mm-hmm.
And because same as in Gorzisk, but also in Bamberg, these smoke breweries produce their own malt the old way. So these are malts really with a high level of smoke, but very nicely integrated. And that produces really nice beer. So that's, of course, my ground. I love it. And I'm happy that you love it too. So that's perfect. And that brings us to your topic. You're researching or working on a new book at the moment. And it all started more or less with the question, how do we taste? So what are your findings? How can we say now, how does it work? How does a human get into the secrets of taste and smell?
Right, well, they're called the chemical senses, right? That's what scientists call them. So that's taste, smell, mouthfeel. And so taste, obviously, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami, maybe a few other things in some ways, but fairly complicated. But those are the primary ones. They're very different. They don't blend together. We have sometimes even multiple different receptors and processing systems for managing them. Even though sweet, either, let's say, for example, salt and sour, extremely simple, is just ions, measuring ions. The systems that do that are extremely complicated, and they've only really recently figured out what they are. And they're not 100% sure on salt. They know there's two, but they think there's another one because when they take out those two, there's still some salt taste left. So there's still a lot of mysteries. And so then there's that, and then there's mouthfeel, which is basically touch sensations on your you know, primarily in your mouth and in your nose. And they respond both to actual physical stimulation as well. So there, so things like tannins. Astringency can be felt as sort of friction or lubrication. Our brains are able to turn those things into sensations, right? And then also heat and cold. And also not just heat and cold, but those feelings, those sensations, those neural impulses really can be transmitted, stimulated by menthol and chili pepper and mustard and various types of chemicals that interact with those receptors. So it's called chemisthesis. It's a very interesting thing to have a texture, like a touch sensor, that should be actually influenced by some chemistry. So that's why we get all those things. And then smell is the most complicated by far. We have 400 receptors. Every one of us is a little different, but not so different that we can't share gastronomy and beers and things, but we all have different sensitivities. And there's certain compounds that are well known. The buttery compound that you might find in a poorly brewed beer called diacetyl, about 10% of people are actually blind to that. So that's an important part of judging or learning to be a taster, is sort of calibrating yourself, which is like judging beer is really great because you can compare yourself to other people at your tables when you're judging, and you know, oh yeah, I'm just not that sensitive to that. Or maybe you're super sensitive to metallic or something. You know, everybody's a little different. But those integrate really rapidly in the brain. As soon as they enter the brain, they go through in their early processing station, and then immediately they start to flow together. And that creates what we call flavor, right? So that's what they call a multimodal sensation, right? That's multi-different sensory modes that all kind of come together to create a single impression. And that's flavor. That's what flavor is. And so part of the job as a taster is to learn to separate those things out. Because if you pick up a glass of wine, for example, and you put it to your nose and you say, ah, it's sweet. It can't be sweet through the nose. It can only be fruity, right? But your brain already knows almost always if there's some fruitiness, there's often sweetness, certainly with actual fruit, not necessarily true with wine, but with actual fruit. That's our learned association. And those really, you have to fight those a little bit sometimes. And fruit's not that hard. There's some other things that may be more difficult. So it's just one of those tricks that you have to learn.
But it's quite a complicated process and quite a complex thing, because it's, on one hand, it's a bit like learning a new language. So because you maybe learn new words for things, or in general, new spells, new mm-hmm. chemical mm-hmm. Compositions, whatever. And on the other hand, you have to reframe things you already know or you already had. For example, diacetyl, if you are a big popcorn lover, mm-hmm. you're maybe very happy with this. And then you have to learn, okay, if it's in a beer, it's maybe different.
Yeah.
And with other things, the same thing. So really, it's not so easy to get into that.
Well, even diacetyl in a beer, it tastes very different in a pale beer than in a dark beer.
Yeah.
And I find myself, if I'm tasting a dark beer and my brain starts thinking about pastry or some dessert, I have to catch myself and think that's probably diacetyl, and so if you think about browned baked products with butter, that's mm-hmm. baked goods. Right, so that's your brain saying this is a baked good, but actually it's beer. It's, you know, but that's how, again, you have to kind of learn to learn those little tricks to know, because you have to learn different chemicals in different contexts.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and also we will, I think, talk about that in a moment, that you have also this different concentrations and things. But first, maybe the general question, we were talking about how we taste, but the question is, why? Is there a reason? Because we could also just not taste and live anyway, or not?
We could, but it would be really boring. people who are born without a sense of smell can live their lives just fine. But people who have a sense of smell and they lose it for some reason, they have a very high rate of depression and even suicide, because it's just really missing a part of their world. And it's a missing part of world that's a really good communication between fellow human beings. So you're able to go out to a bar and drink some beer, eat some food, you talk about it, you share it. And it's like people who are lose their hearing, they become socially isolated sometimes in ways that they don't really always realize, you know, that can be very isolating, and it can lead to dementia, and can lead, like, all these things have knock-on effects that are important. So you know, it's just like, you want to live your life, you want to experience things, and you want to pay attention to what's around you, and that's just another tool for it.
Yeah, and that's more or less in the modern society, mm-hmm. but is there also a more basic reason? So do we need it as beings?
We do. The earliest creature, there's not a species of animal that's ever lived on this planet that has not had a chemical sense. Before there were bacteria, whatever was before bacteria, the last universal common ancestor, it had a sense of taste, smell, something, because it could sense a gradient in its environment, and if it was food, it could move towards it. And the sensory part of the cell was directly in the little motor that powers the flagellum that propels the creature. So a positive smell drives it towards it, and a negative smell, it turns the other way and it backs up. So, and that's the function of smell today for everybody, for all creatures, great and small. It's that function. So when you fight it sometimes with your sense of smell, you know, you really want a word, and it's giving you a feeling. You know, that's things you have to learn, but that's what it, don't blame your sense of smell, because that's what it's for. That's how it works. And so you have to understand that. That was one of the more amazing revelations to me. It's like, yeah, we're all creatures have that, just in one way or another.
Yeah. So in general, we react to our environment. We if we have something attractive like food or other attractive
sex.
Things,
yes.
we turn to it and we like that. But maybe is there a difference between, I think, many animals, like let's have a bee or something that flies where it's sweet or something like that. I think humans, I'm a little bit able to control. Of course, when I'm shopping food, when I'm hungry, I shop differently yeah. if I'm not. Yeah. But still, I do not eat immediately in the supermarket. So, yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very differently. I mean, you know, the less evolutionary advancement there is in the creature, the more direct the connections are between the senses and their actions. And even mice and rats and other mammals, like a rat, when it's not hungry, can't smell food. So it literally, the sense of smell, just the sensitivity drops way out. The same with salt. If they need salt, that salt tastes really good and it's very sensitive, but at some point, the salty taste goes away and they don't need it. We don't work that way. Because another big discovery from reading all this research is that human beings and our ape cousins, and some other animals too, can they transfer functions that in smaller creatures are done in more autonomic ways with the brain stem and with the lower limbic parts of the brain and direct connections between sensation and action. Whereas in humans, we can smell food even when we're hungry, but you know, and monkeys can do that too. If there's ripe fruit on a tree and a monkey swings by and it's like, oh, that smells really good, but I'm not hungry right now, but I know where it is. I'm going to make a note of that. I'll come back when I'm hungry. So that's like the cognitive brain taking over for, and even some basic things like the sense of salt. We manage that with our cognitive brains. Other animals, they have to have it, you know. But we know that, like, we're hairless creatures. We sweat to cool off. We lose salt faster and more differently than most other animals. So it's beneficial to us if we know we're going to go out and run all day chasing gazelles. We got to load up on salt, like the football players they give salt pills to in high school. You know, they used to anyway. And so we can manage that because our brains can do that for us, right? We can think about what we do.
Yeah, so it's like a new dimension that we add on, that we can say, okay, maybe I come back to eat that later or whatever.
It just gives us so much adaptability and the flexibility to interact with the world in really complex ways that are advantageous for us. Mm.
And if I come across a lot of modern people, which are more or less living in their houses, going to work in another house, always in a close surrounding. Maybe they have perfumes or things like that, but not like a natural environment. So do these people lose the natural senses or can they come back if you train that or how does that work?
No, they're still there. A part of the problem is that we don't depend on our sense of smell very much in the industrialized world. We enjoy it. We use it. We drink wine. We engage with it. But it's not a matter of survival for us anymore. Whereas people in the wild, you know, they're chasing animals. They can smell. They can tell where they've been. They can smell where they've been. They look for all the other things and visual signs and sounds and all that. But they depend highly on those senses. So they're more tuned in for sure. But our receptors are one of the few places of our nervous systems that actually get replaced frequently. So within about 2 or 3 weeks, if you were to move from the city to live out in the country, you would have some different receptors. You'd have some different capabilities just based on what you were smelling out there.
That is interesting. So, for example, a long time I had a dog and it was able to really follow roots, trace smells. So would you say humans are able to do that too?
It's been demonstrated that humans can. There's some science papers where they would take a rag and put some chocolate sauce on it and drag it around a field and then put blank folded people on their hands and knees, and they send them through the field, and they can just zigzag. They swing their head from side to side to see which side the smell is stronger, and then they go in that direction. They take little sniffs, like dogs sniff, you know, just short sniffs, and because that's sniffs are actually a mechanism to trigger neural synchronization between parts of the brain. It's not just intaking air; it's actually a neural event that synchronizes all the different parts that are communicating with each other. So it tells the brain, like, get into smelling mode right now. And so humans have done really well. With a little practice, they get really good. Are they as good as bloodhounds? I don't know. Probably not. You know,
not as bad as we think.
We're much better than we think we are. I mean, most people generally don't think they're very good at it. And it's not because of their genes. It's because they don't put a lot of effort into it and don't think about it on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. You know, you have to really focus on smell, especially.
And you said it's 400 receptors.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we already added a little that they are also reacting to different concentrations.
Mm-hmm.
But if I think, let's say, about a pineapple or an apple or a piece of chocolate, I think in this, so I have the apple in my internal eyes. How does that work? How does the body translate the receptors into, let's say, an apple?
Well, each chemical may stimulate multiple receptors and different receptors as the concentration goes up and down. So, and then each receptor can bind to different chemicals. So an apple has a whole bunch of different esters. There's closely related receptors that can all smell those esters. And so that transmits a sort of a, almost think about it like a digital grid of responses into your brain from different receptors.
So like a barcode or something.
Kind of like a barcode, right? Oh. But you have a part of your brain that presents itself at the top of the olfactory bulb and into the brain. And that, at that point, is chemical responses to chemistry. But the brain looks down on it, and the only thing they use it for is a template to identify a memory. And once that connection has been made with the brain, all the chemical response information is thrown out. So smells present in a way that's very complex, but the brain simplifies it into meaning, value, and context. Right, so it translates it into psychological terms. That's a currency of what the brain does, because the brain doesn't need the chemistry. It's useless. It's just like a pattern, you know. It's like recognizing a face. It's the same neural process, the same organization of the neurons in those parts that recognize those patterns, as in the sections of the brain where we look at faces. And faces are meaningful, not because there's information in the face, but because it's recognition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see you and I know you now. And like next time I see you, a whole bunch of memories about this talk and everything else I know about you will kind of come back. But the face itself is just a signifier for it. Yeah. It contains no real information in and of itself. So it's really interesting the way it does it. And that gives you flavors that are very hard to pull apart. You know, Coca-Cola is made of lemon, orange blossom, lime, coriander, nutmeg, and cinnamon. And it doesn't smell like any of those things. But when you put them all together in the right ratios, your brain just clicks. Because it doesn't store the chemistry. It just stores like that combined thing.
And that also means, if you come back to the example of the apple, that's like a universal language. Because even if my receptors are a bit different to yours, if we both have the idea this is an apple, we can talk about it.
Exactly. So despite our genetic differences and our other differences too, we easily share because we're sharing psychological things about value and what this is and what's appropriate and how it's supposed to taste. And you probably got a template for different varieties of apples. And the people that know wine, they have thousands of templates for different kinds of wine, different kinds of grapes in different regions, at different seasons with different weather. You know, so their level of detail of all of that stuff, they're sort of index file, like index cards of all these things. That's how they organize them, is by variety, region, and then, you know, weather and terroir things. So it could really be as complex as it could. I mean, it can be incredibly complex as wine is, because the way it's related to terroir and varietal and everything. You know, in beer we think in styles. And styles, and you know, the German styles are a little different in Germany than they are in the U.S., but not always. So they don't have to be, but they sometimes are. So it's a little different, you know. There's a little different, but those sort of are what our language. That plus kind of off flavors and sort of quality related flavors that people are important to know as brewers, to know what the flaws are and how to recognize them in different contexts, and when some phenol is appropriate and when it's not appropriate and all of that kind of thing. So
that is really interesting for me right now, because I'm in the beer education. I try to find a new approach to talking about the beer styles thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, let's say, the BJCP or something like that, you have always these guidelines with numbers and things. And I normally tend to explain to people the idea of the beer style. Mm-hmm. So why was it invented, where it was coming from, what was the surroundings, the idea, how it was enjoyed, what was all about that beer. Mm-hmm. And really my finding is that it's somehow this is easier, because if people understand what is the idea of a style, it's maybe easier for them to judge it, because they have pictures in mind. And they can see if that what they have in the mouth is according to that.
Yeah.
It's much easier than to guess about IBUs or things like that.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. Well,
I think the other thing that's really important about beer, and I didn't really mention it, is that beer is incredibly process-oriented. Every aspect of beer, certainly in agriculture, but we think about that less except for hops, which the agriculture is very much like grapes in the forefront. We think about it less with malt. But malt comes into the malt house all one thing, and it leaves, like just talking to Environment, they make 88 different kinds of products.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, all out of more or less kind of the same stuff. And but those are all that cooking process. So understanding every part of the brewing process, starting with how the malt is made, and understanding where the flavors come from in very pale kiln malts, and then darker malts, and caramel malts, and black malts, and all of those things. They each have some chemistry, they each have some process, they have certain characteristics, different other ways they behave. And then once you get into the brewing process, it's exactly the same way. How you mash, how you boil, when you put the hops in, and so understanding those processes gives you that insight. That's the context part of the way we categorize flavors. And the people who are really good at this, they can smell a beer and they can go down and write a recipe for it and figure out pretty much how to get something that's pretty similar in the glass. And then people do get that way with experience.
And what is a bit fun is that this is about the same answer I get if I talk to a German brewer about the purity law, because they say, and that's totally right, that if you know about the process, if you know about the raw materials, about everything, you can make so many different beers that it's simply not necessary to put a marshmallow into your beer. And that's their common thing.
We make a marshmallow. We don't actually use marshmallows, but we have a toasted marshmallow Schwarz beer that we make at Forbidden Root, a brewery in Chicago. So, I mean, I'm not why would a chef not use basil, or I don't know, I understand how it came about, and I understand people's love for the restriction, because sometimes restriction really can improve art. If you can do just anything, it's harder in a way, but I don't adhere to that.
Yeah.
I would rather, and maybe that's just my American nature, don't tell me what to do. I don't want to. I talked to the owner of Eyinger one time, and he said, we have a tax form that has checkboxes for styles. And if we want to make something that's not that doesn't have a checkbox, we can't do it. It's like, I would not want to live like that. I guess that, it's sort of the double-edged sword of tradition. That on the one hand, it's really comforting and nice, and there's this great quality of knowing things have been around forever. But on the other hand, people want to innovate. They want to express themselves somehow. And it's very hard to do that with a with a pilsner. You can a little, but it's really subtle. And I don't know. Yeah, maybe people have different points of view about it.
Maybe the key is to have both of that. So on one side,
no problem with that.
Yeah, to are really aware of all of the process and the raw materials. On the other side, to have the whole bunch of ingredients and things. And if you do that together, then you can really create fantastic beers.
You never don't need to understand the process.
Yeah.
And when you get into when you start working with fruits and botanicals and those kinds of things, it's even more complicated, because each one of those has its own set of chemistry. Peaches, for example, there's a chemical in peaches that the food scientists call fuzzy peach smell. It's unstable during fermentation, right? It just like oxidizes or something and goes away in fermentation, which is why peach beers are kind of terrible. But if you know that, and so we do a lot of research on when we do things. We really try and understand them pretty deeply, so that when we're working with them, we're working with information and not just tossing stuff in.
Yeah. If you say we, so you are involved at a brewery.
I'm involved at a brewery called Forbidden Root in Chicago. We have two brewery restaurants in Chicago. We have a brewery restaurant in Columbus, Ohio. And then we also we put some beer in the market, some brewed at our own places. And we, for our larger brands, we have those contracted at a larger, better, more quality oriented brewery than we can manage at a pub down in southern central Illinois.
And as you had now made all these research for your new book and have these fantastic findings we were just talking about, did that change your approach to the beers in the brewery or to the food in the restaurants or in general, your personal tasting, drinking, eating? Did you have some changes?
Well, we made a peach beer. I just talked about peaches. Mm-hmm. And I thought our distributor thought we might have an opportunity for another beer besides our strawberry basil Hefeweizen. Because it's a big seller for us. They thought, well, what else could you make for that customer? And it's like, I'm thinking about a peach beer. But again, the problem is peaches, the peachy character goes away. So we have to fix that. So first thing we did is we put in a Chinese tree flower called sweet osmanthus. It has a beautiful peachy aroma to it. They use it for tea. And so we put that in on the cold side post-fermentation. So now we don't have to worry about fermentation taking the chemical out of there. And then I consulted a big book on called Flavor Creation, written by a famous food scientist, flavorist. And they suggested in that book some natural flavor, like essential oils and other natural flavors that are used sometimes in peach flavorings. And we looked at the whole list, we tried a bunch of things, and we ended up with jasmine, chamomile, orange peel, rose, mahled, which is a Middle Eastern cherry pit, and sweet osmanthus. Or I'm sorry, it's the sweet osmanthus I mentioned, but the other one was orris root, which is a Florentine iris, which has a violets. Are this Florent? It's this very profound, deep, vague fruitiness that has a long length on the palate. And so these are all flavors that sort of dance around the edge of peach flavor. And so what we found is not only did we help strengthen the peach and brought some of the peach back with that osmanthus, but that each one of those flavor notes add elements of interest and complexity to the beer. So it drinks a little more like wine, even though it's a Belgian wit beer style as the base. It has the complexity of a wine where you notice one thing and then you notice another thing and then you notice another thing. And it also brings a lot greater length in the mouth, even though it's, you know, a 5% beer, but it lingers in the mouth a little bit in really interesting ways. And the flavors change as it goes through it. So,
wow. That is impressive. So I think the audience and myself, we all are now eager to come to Chicago and visit the brewery and the places. In general, about your new book, so is there some other things you want to mention? What are you planning to do? And maybe how can we maybe get it? Is there a date or something?
Well, my publisher has decided after 6 years of work that it's too long.
Okay.
Not 6 years is too long. The book's too long. So I'm waiting for an email from them saying, are we publishing this book? Not publishing? Like, what's going on with the book? It will be, chances are, early 2026 before we're done. It's a university publisher. They move very slowly. But we wanted that imprimatur of respectability and, you know, that this is coming from a reputable source. And I'm really ready to be done working on it. And so it's basically the first four or five chapters are really about the science of a taste, feel, mouth feel, a section on how we organize smells, a section on language, a section on how the smells combine or how the senses combine. And then there's a chapter on flavor chemistry. And so I've started to learn to think in chemical terms, in terms of esters and aldehydes and other compounds. That's another language for me. And that's like, I'm applying that to wine, I'm applying that to beer, and just making sure that I understand, oh, if I get something that's sort of grassy or maybe a little fatty, it's probably an aldehyde. And then you can understand like how aldehydes get formed during various parts of plant growth or fermentation or different kinds of things. And so it's, again, just a different way of having insight. And then there's a chapter on fermented beverages, a chapter on distilled beverages, and then two chapters at the end, one of which focuses on how tasting is done professionally with taste panels and different kinds of biases that are sort of accounted for by different methods during tasting. And then the final chapter is all right, here's, you want to be a taster. Like, this is what your journey is going to look like. Here's some things you need to think about. I put beer and food back there because that just seemed like the logical place. Glassware, there's, you know, a limited amount of studies, almost nothing on beer, honestly, that seems to be worth anything. But a little bit on wine. There's not a huge amount of knowledge there about that. Very limited science on glassware, although I think psychologically it's hugely important because it sets expectations in certain ways. And as brewers, half of our job is managing people's expectations in a way that when they finally taste our beer, they have the right frame of mind to not be intimidated, to not be worried about it, to just like really embrace it and enjoy it. I think that's that part of that communication. Some people like, let them figure it out for themselves, but it's very important to frame it properly and talk, use your language very carefully and your imagery, whatever, to prepare people for what the experience is going to be like.
So, perfect. We are almost done with our beer, so we will enjoy the last sip. Yeah. Thank you very much. You will be a little bit longer here in Poland, so what are you expecting from the Polish beer?
A few days. Well, we judged beer, we judged best of show, so we really had a very good, like a cross-section of the best of Polish beer. We were quite impressed with everything, and it's been really fun being here. I love the community here. It's been very enthusiastic, a lot of energy, a lot of creativity. People really, really want this to be successful. And I'm, you know, just looking forward to some traditional food and maybe some more modern food and tour around and just have the experience of being in Krakow for a while. And I'm really excited to be here. I will just tell people that if I'm starting to... I'm getting very close to publishing a bi-weekly newsletter on the book and some of my travels. So if they want to sign up, they can go to randymosher.com and just click through and sign up for it. Or if they want to contact me for any reason, I'm very available and they can get me on that site. So
perfect. So I will put the link also in the show notes, and I already signed up for the newsletter, so please do.
Fantastic.
And thank you very much. And let's have another beer later. Yeah, bye.
Yep.
Beer Talk. Der Podcast rund ums Bier. Alle Folgen unter www.biertalk.de.